Hey everybody, and welcome to Space Force. Oh man, well, hello everybody, and welcome to Space Force. I'm Jason.
I'm Theo.
I'm Don.
We have a special guest, Don. Welcome aboard. Don is a longtime friend of the show, and Don, you come to us from a podcasting. You do a lot of podcast stuff, a lot of Starfinder and Pathfinder stuff.
Yep.
Let me see if I got all this down. You, of course. Are you the GM for Hex Grid Heroes?
Yep.
Which is that's audio show doing a homebrew.
Homebrew, but heavily set in the Pact World setting because I don't trust myself to create a whole galaxy like some people. I'm very comfortable playing in other people's sandbox and then just introducing my own little toys occasionally.
Yeah, right on. And then you just started Horizons Unknown, which is a playthrough of the Horizons of the Vast adventure path.
Yes.
The last volume of which, by the way, we just sent to approvals yesterday on Friday.
Excellent. I've been refreshing my email every 2.5 days. I'm very excited to see what you've brought with it.
And Thea, you contributed to every volume of that. And it's been super exciting to see that and get your credits straight in the last volume, by the way. And then you play in a Pathfinder second edition live real show, real play.
Yep. I get to play a kobold swashbuckler, get to be a little little piratey boy, and I mostly GM, but I'm comfortable in the GM spot, but very much enjoying playing that system and learning that system. So I play a lot. I do a lot.
I started playing a lot of Pathfinder second edition myself when I became a senior developer and I became in charge of developing a Pathfinder adventure path. And I'm like, I've written these things before and I've played the game before, you know, but you're a lot better when you're playing it and you're learning it and you're seeing how, and also how the game is evolving because new books are coming out all the time. And that means the game is constantly changing and we've got to keep up with it.
Yep.
But we are not here to talk about Pathfinder or Starfinder. We are here to talk about the latest episode of Star Trek Discovery, The Examples. And I could not help but laugh the minute we had like the 5-minute intro. And I realized that here it is, the episode of Discovery we always joked we would never see, a whole episode about rescuing 6 people. And here it is, right? So it is set in this cosmic disaster. So there's still a gigantic cosmic anomaly, the DMA, threatening an entire station with a thousand or more people on board.
1206.
The Discovery and multiple other ships go there to evacuate. And that evacuation proceeds pretty much according to plan. We get some quick drive-by characterization from the commander who I want to touch on. But the real challenge comes with these 6 prisoners who are kept in a special part of the station, secure, and the people that live on the station, the leader of the station doesn't want to let them be evacuated. And so our heroes, Book and Burnham, go in to rescue these people under a no one left behind mandate, which creates tension at the end when, despite all of their efforts and they get all the way through and they're on their way out, when one of these people, and we need to talk about Felix, the guy who decides to stay behind, Felix decides that he deserves to stay, that he does not deserve to be rescued, that he is doing a punishment for a crime that he committed, and he's going to stay on the station. And this creates a rift between Burnham and Book because Book can't take not rescuing someone. It's got to be like we got to save every single person. And that's how that plot line resolves. Meanwhile, Stamets and a new character, the scientist, Ruan Tarka. Stamets and Ruan Tarka are figuring out the DMA, and they conclude that it is guided by some kind of intelligent force. It was created. It has some kind of control module at the center. And they build a tiny replica of this, which is small enough to fit in a room. And despite feeding it all the power of the Discoveries, they can't quite figure out what's going on with it, but they do almost blow up the ship in the process. And then our plot C is a little bit of Cobra psychological maintenance as he has this delightful 10-minute encounter. Well, it's supposedly 10 minutes, but it's probably much shorter with Cronenberg, whose character name is irrelevant because it's always going to be Cronenberg. And we find out kind of what's going on with Culber. He's suffering under a lot of psychological stress, and he's trying to be a counselor for the entire crew. And everyone's the crew are under a lot of stress, and they're all dumping that on him. So he's under a lot of stress. But we learn from this conversation that there's more to it than that. That Culber has come back to life, and he's never really dealt with the ramifications of that. Like, well, what does that mean? And the implication is that he feels incredible guilt for coming back to life. Why him? Why does he come back and nobody else does? And so now what am I going to do about that? And they don't resolve that, but we do see Culber and Stamets kind of chat, talking about it in a healthy, comfortable, kind of laughing way. Like, you know, the entire galaxy is falling apart. We can't get our shit together. Kind of in a way that reminded me very much of the way couples talk when they acknowledge that they've got something they're going to have to resolve. And they haven't figured it out yet, but it seems to be something that they can at least talk about. And that's kind of the plots as far as we saw it. There wasn't a lot. We know that the big meta plot development was that we know that the DMA is created, is artificial, but we don't know why, or we don't know. Well, so let's start with our thoughts or responses. Thea, what did you think when you watched the show?
So, I know you liked it.
I did.
For me, I'm a little... There were moments of brilliance in the episode that I quite liked, but I felt like this was sort of like a yeoman, okay, we got to remind you of the plot, the meta plot. We have to introduce a couple new elements. We're going to tease you a little bit. With this episode was like sort of rife with Star Trek lore,
yeah,
from all eras of Trek,
yeah,
which is fun for me because I get to know it out. But I think it was detracting from the main setup.
Okay, you called various episodes a yeoman episode before, and my impression is what you mean by that is it's kind of a workman episode, like it's kind of a filler. Like we're not going to resolve anything, but we're going to kind of make incremental steps towards resolving things, but nothing big.
And that's like season threes were definitely that. They were workman episodes. They were enough to like remind you of the big plot points and the themes of the episode. This episode at least gave us the encapsulation of Felix's plot.
Yeah. Felix.
So that plot has a beginning, middle, and end, which is contrasting to the other two subplots.
Yeah.
Even though there was a little like book is not okay because of that decision that's made at the end, because Felix is no longer with us at the end of the episode, his story is done. So that gives the episode some semblance of closure.
Yeah. Somebody got an arc in this show, and it was Felix. Yeah.
Done. It was Commander Reese.
Yes. Definitely want to talk about Commander Reese. Yeah. I have the word finally written several times in my notes. Kind of a good melding of both of your viewpoints. I very much enjoyed taking the little beats we had with some of the characters. I also felt a yeoman episode was a brilliant way of putting it. And all the little nuggets, I watched it twice before coming here. So the second time I had Memory Alpha up on my phone the entire time. that kind of stuff, I'm that person when you watch a movie either literally on IMDb or my mental IMDb is going off and I'm just like mining it. I'm a terrible date.
There was a lot of that with this episode, like literally from the very first moment when it's like, okay, here's the USS Janeway.
Like, yeah, T'Pau, and I'm like, ooh, T'Pau, and then I search it, I'm like, wait, there were a couple T'Pau. So I had my work cut out for me keeping up and pausing it. but I very much enjoyed the tension that was brought in, the way the music backing, they really drove home just how dire it is that this wasn't a natural phenomenon. Someone caused this, and just the somber looks at everyone when that realization was hitting people. I'm like, oh, they really want me to care that this, they really are selling me on the idea. Like, this isn't cosmic ephemera. This is machinations of some entity of some kind. So
yeah, we don't know yet if it's hostile. Like, if it's a weapon, you'd think it would be directed more obviously aggressively, right? Like, it would be like, okay, we've made this giant super weapon and we're gonna just start blowing up planets with it, right? Yeah. But it's not. Go ahead.
Oh, I have a very, I think, too easy of a solution to what all this is, and I'll wait to reveal it. But like Thea, you did last year, I'm calling it now. and
you did a lot of that, and I ate some crow.
I will deep fry that crow with some mashed potatoes and some peas. So yeah, I'm game.
Well, so let's have that speculation conversation. Like, when they list, the Admiral lists some potential candidates for the mind behind the DMA. And I still don't like calling it the DMA. I would be happy when we come up with some other name for it. But I think that's what they decided to call it. That's Stamets' name for it, which is very Stamets. Mm-hmm. The Iconians, who, of course, I remember. And as a longtime Star Trek Online player, the Iconians are a major, major story element in that.
Too much so, some would say.
Yeah,
I agree. big player as well. And I'm like, oh, we're doing the Iconians again. Okay.
Yeah.
Mystery.
And of course, Q, which even the Admiral quickly dismisses as not their style. But then there were a couple of others who I didn't recognize. The Metrons? Who the hell are the Metrons?
Well, the Metrons are from the Arena, which is the episode of the Gong. Yes. So he's the pretty boy. He's that pretty twink that shows up at the end. He's like, you, yeah, in 1,000 years, maybe you'll be advanced enough for me to have a conversation with you.
Yeah.
Now we're 1,000 years removed from that. So that's why I think they had to throw the Metrons out there. We acknowledge that we know of this thing, but we're not going to do the Metrons because we have listed 3 other candidates.
All right. And Don, who were the other candidate, the other one that I didn't catch?
The Nassim, the kind of ooze people that were very, not very prominent, but were kind of like the catalyst of the Voyager series. The caretaker at that station that I can't remember the name of.
In the first
Sun Point? Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, they, and I think a reason why they might have ruled out, because I can only imagine what the Metron, because we saw how Discovery has done the Klingons, how they've done Tellarites, and how they've done Ferengi.
Yeah.
I can only imagine. Look at the Metron, and great description. The twink with the powdery makeup. Mm-hmm. Imagine that. Like, that was advanced then. What are you going to do, Discovery makeup department, to make them seem like, no, we haven't changed at all because we are already top tier? Like, you can't make them look any more like Adonis.
So who do you think what do you think is the story behind the DMA? Don, you have a theory, so let's hear it.
It's Ron Tarka.
Ah, you think he made it?
I think he makes it later because he says, like, oh, here's the schematics, and he just flings them over of the controller. And then the experiment begins, and, you know, oh, it's something technobabble, which I love, thrown through a space-time continuum. And I feel like future Tarka does it accidentally or on purpose because of that ambition that he and Stamets share.
Okay,
I think it gets flung back. He can't control it. He may have all the brains and stuff, but he can't control it. And so now past Tarka, I think current Tarka is dealing with his future mistakes.
All right, so you think that there's some timey-wimey stuff going on?
I won't. Yes, I'm just going to have to double down. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thea, what's your theory, or do you have one?
I'm really trying not to write the show.
Yeah,
fair.
Like, because there's a lot of biases. Like, those things, like, I would love for them to reveal that this is tied to the Doomsday Machine. I would love for them to reveal that this is tied to the Force Federation somehow. Like those classic things in Trek that has never been mentioned. Like, I thought it was interesting that the Organians were omitted from that list.
Yeah.
Like, the Organians are the most well-known super race outside of the Q continuum.
Right.
The other two point things I want to point out is they have grandfathered in sort of the online, like they've toned canon the Star Trek Online plot point, because they mentioned that those refugees of that race, and prior to that, canon had always been, it was a dead race and only those technologies survived. The other thing was, tune in 6 weeks for Star Trek Picard, because we haven't heard from the Geek Continuum since the 25th century, because we can do math pretty quickly.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yep.
So this is not just a Q story. This is going to probably wind up being the last Q story.
Right, the last Q story.
So it'd be like the Logan of Q.
Wow, I want to watch that.
So I don't really have a theory. My thinking is Don might be onto something. I do think that there's going to be a reveal that recontextualizes what is happening. And I bring that up because Zora has now developed emotions. Mm-hmm. And remember, my hang up on season 3 was trying to get everything to line up with Calypso, which I still think is the best Star Trek story ever told. I'll throw that out there. Like, I really think highly of Calypso in terms of taking what Star Trek does and humanizing it in such a interpersonal way. Having said that, I don't want to fall down that rabbit hole of trying to like start writing the show. Other candidates could be like the prophets. This could be like some sort of way that they're contacting us.
Intern of Avery Brooks. I don't know if he's.
I don't think Avery Brooks is ever going to do it. He's happy. Like, we as fans want to see the Cisco return, right? Like, that's the thing. Like, we want to see the Cisco return because that's what's prophesied. That's what they tease, so that Avery Brooks was not perpetuating the narrative of an absentee black father. Like, that's specifically line was written there in that finale. I don't think we're ever going to see it because the actor was super happy doing his jazz on his piano, man. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to harsh Avery Brooks' buzz and be like,
not at all.
No, you got to report to a makeup chair and you got to strap on the spacesuit.
Yep.
I find it very interesting. I'm not sure that I'm going to buy into your theory, Don. It's interesting, but I think that the show is avoiding any more time gimmicks for dramatic purposes because they've already kind of, you know, drank from that well so extensively in season 2.
Yep. Season 2. I'm not staking my online reputation behind it or anything. Yeah, it's just a couple of and I'm probably buying it right into whatever they're actually doing, but it just feels so like, oh, I'm a genius. I atomized live animals. That's not a red flag.
There's something going on with that guy with Tarka. At the end of the episode, they bring two of the plots together. Book and Tarka are sitting at the bar and comparing their day, sharing their day. And Tarka makes some observation about anger, and he specifically shows a scar on the back of his neck to Book. And Book seems to recognize it, and they share some kind of unspoken understanding as Tarka walks away.
Yeah, I had notes the second time. The first time I was shoving cookies in my face. And so I didn't see what that was, but I was getting strong Sorin from Generations vibes from him, where he's just like, oh, you have plans and ideas, and just very
interesting.
Making moves.
But so he's an interesting character, Tarka is. It's interesting that even 1,000 years in the future, Risa is still the pleasure planet. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, he's total Ed. He is unrepentant, just Ed run amok.
Yeah, he is. He is. And I found it interesting how he interacted with Stamets, because Stamets kind of follows his lead. Tarka seems to have this way of getting people to do what he wants. whether it's getting Stamets to follow along with him and back him up, or even, you know, getting Saru to scream at him, you know?
Yeah.
And Tark is a villain, I think. But I don't know what's going on. I think I'm interested to see what's going on. I assumed that mark was some kind of emerald chain thing or something that maybe.
What did the mark look like? I must have blinked.
It's circular. I didn't get any details. Don.
It was definitely a perception check kind of thing, because it, like, he just like adjusts his collar and Book the empath sees it, and we see that Book sees it, but that's it.
Yeah.
Because I saw Book's reaction, and because there was no supporting dialogue to it, recognized that there had been any movement since it was two people sitting at a ball. So I completely missed it. But a circular, like, it could be an emerald chain thing, and I don't want to get my hopes up, but we could be dealing with a contagion follow-up from the next generation with the parasite people.
Oh, no.
Those were circular wounds too. But I'm not going to go there because I'm not writing the show.
Yeah, yeah. I forgot about that. I went when you all talked about it last season. I'm like, what's that episode? And I watch it, and boy, that episode. like,
imagine watching that as a 7-year-old and just being like,
"Yep,
my whole world is recontextualized by that 1 hour of television."
Yep, I took a pause from my DS9 binge to go watch that episode, and I'm like, this, I don't use this line lightly, but like, this isn't Star Trek. We don't blow up heads.
Like, yeah.
Heads. This is Holy Grail face melting gruesome. I'm like, I don't recall this. I must have pushed that one out of my mind.
That twinkling noise that actually does haunt me in my sleep. Every now and then I'll hear it in my dreams. And I'll be like, damn you, Roddenberry.
They're characterizing Tarka in a very interesting way. When he uses his mashed potatoes and pea metaphor, it's a classic example of trying to show a practical field scientist as compared to a theoretical one, right? And it's kind of there's this famous moment in the investigation into the Challenger explosion, when Richard Feynman takes an O-ring and all the members of the panel are being asked about what might have happened. And Feynman's at the end of the line. And they start at the one side. And when the conversation starts with the first person, he takes a sample O-ring and he drops it in his ice water. And he doesn't say anything. And they just keep going from one person to the next, to the next, to the next. By the time they get to him, he pulls the O-ring out of the ice water and it's all turned and twisted because of the cold. And he says, this is exactly what happened, right? And it's kind of one of those moments, right? It's like a way, like a science educator where we show you a physical example of what's actually happening. And it helps people relate to it. And with a good scientist, this becomes a way to educate and to teach. And people are like, oh yeah, I get it. Like, I don't understand quantum mechanics. I don't understand subspace, you know, rips, but I understand mashed potatoes and a pea. Right. And so they're working hard to both make Tarka both endearing and yet also very dangerous. When Saru is talking to them and Stamets twice does this, he looks right at Saru and he says, I can handle this. I'll take care of it. And that's an incredible thing for Stamets to say and Saru to trust him and then for it not to work. Like, no, in almost any other episode, if Stamets looks Saru in the eye and says, I can do this, then we would successfully have resolved that experiment by the end of the show. Thea?
There was one episode that I was reminded of. Good. Once he turned to the camera and said, I can do this, I'm like, no, you're not going to do this. Because I also remember the Omega Directive, which is an episode where 7 of 9 sees God.
It's okay.
Basically, the bull have a perfect molecule. It's like the Omega
Directive. I remember.
And it's coalescing, like, right, like, and Janeway's yanking her out of the lab because everything's going to blow up. And she's just about to see God. I'm like, that's what's going to happen. We're going to just about to see God, and you're not going to get your thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and this does set up what's going to happen when they repeat the experiment under safer conditions, presumably, and they give it the power that it needs, and whatever happens is going to reveal some huge secret, presumably whoever is behind the DMA. We're going to, if we can complete the experiment, we would learn the thing, the big secret, which is what's going on.
Mm-hmm. I'm sort of ambivalent that there was someone involved, to be honest, that there was an entity of some shape or fashion. Because we've done this plot. We did this plot last season. Like, the entity happened to be benign. Ultimately, it was
yes.
Luke's circumstances and a child crying out for his mother.
Yes.
So it was we couldn't blow it up with Faisals.
Right.
The idea that, like, the reason why I like Don's idea that maybe they've done it, like, themselves, because then you don't blow yourselves up with Faisals in Star Trek. I'm wondering, like, what sort of show Discovery is, because we've already done this plot point of giant cataclysm, massive effect. Now we're gonna blow up a side character. We're gonna blow up, like, I'm just kind of, it's weird that you say this is a show written in the pandemic, because we don't get to blow up anything with COVID.
Yeah,
like, we don't get to have that real world catharsis, and they're trying to tap into that sort of emotion of, like, we spent all episode with people allegedly off camera just filling their time with activities in a stay at home, you know, stay in place kind of situation. That was last episode, presumably for the whole crew, but Tilly. Like, Tilly doesn't get a break. So I'm sort of weirded out that they're saying, okay, this is going to be a COVID-like scenario that your emotions are being tapped into, because we were feeling those emotions when we wrote it, but now we're going to blow up a thing? Like, I don't know.
Maybe that's cathartic. Maybe that's what audiences want. They want to be able to punch the problem, and I don't know.
And that's, like, that's a problem I have with the adaptation of Watchmen, right? Like, Ozymandias gets beaten up by Night Owl, and it's a moment of empowerment. And in the comic, that doesn't happen. Right. That's only there for my gratification as an audience member, that I need the catharsis because I can't quite comprehend what has happened. So you're giving me this emotional thing. And I think it's a betrayal of the source material. And I think it's kind of a betrayal of the source material here in the Star Trek situation, because we don't get to blow the thing up.
Well, we're assuming we're going to get to blow this thing up. We don't really know how it's going to happen, right?
I really hope that we don't go in that direction. And that's why I'm not writing the show.
Yeah. So this is a recurring theme. So, Don, you mentioned the commander, and you had your big finally notes about it. Tell us what you thought of that very quick scene.
Yep. Yes. It's been a common statement across the series of, and Jason, you yourself, this is the Michael Burnham show.
Yeah.
For better or worse. Michael's great. Love the actress. But, like, sure. I'm looking at the bridge crew, and Thea, I think you've intimated this as well. Like, we don't get to see, like, we get sidelong glances from Detmer and Awokashun, Reese and Michaels. Nice. Yes. They'll share looks, and that's all we get from them. But this time we got the, when Reese walks up, I'd like to volunteer. I'm like, what are we doing here? What are we doing here? And it wasn't enough. It was a start.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was like my family, my hometown was swept away in a hurricane. I understand. And I'm like, that's an attempt. There was an attempt, everyone. But, like, are you going to build off that at all? Are we, like, we didn't get a payoff of, like, how he felt having accomplished that, because, you know, he did for others what Starfleet did for him and his.
That's true. There was no follow-up, and it would have been nice to get even just a 10-second follow-up remark.
Just a pan of him, like, you know, standing. He could have been smug a little bit.
Yeah.
I would have been cool with it, but.
Yeah, he could have had the Reichel pose, the one leg up,
yep.
while directing, like,
yes.
people with an. With
yes.
That's all we're taking.
That's all it was.
You just have Coble, like, taking, like, a huddled woman and just move along off camera. Yes. That's yep. it.
That's there all. Yeah, like it was nice. Endearing, and it was nice, and the little hologram of him that shows up on the planetoid, I'm like, oh, you're checking in, cool, and they have a little moment, and I'm like, okay, cool, and then nothing, because
so this I really feel like this is a good example, and what it reminded me of everything we've seen so far, it reminded me of the surfing shtick that we got from the other officer a couple of episodes ago. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Who was that?
That was Bryce.
Yeah. Okay. So Bryce is like, oh yeah, like, I surfed on my home planet. And and this is what we're getting. There's two kinds of characterization on this show now. And this is a season four thing. This is this has started this season. Mm-hmm. First, they've really stratified the characters into two ranks. You've got Burnham, Book, Saru, Stamets,
Culber,
and Adira, right? Who was not in this episode, but they can't get them for every episode. So that they have those six, and that's the main cast. And then everybody else is going to get these drive-by characterization moments, right? Where we're going to, in some ways, it's better than what we had last season. Like, we would get that bits with Detmer, you know, like everybody mm-hmm. would come to the dinner, and Detmer had this recurring subplot that went nowhere, right? And it was just really frustrating. And in some ways, I actually prefer the, you know, I was a surfer, or my family was ruined by a hurricane. I mm-hmm. actually kind of prefer those moments to these like long extended subplots that are basically just 100% teased, you know?
That's fair. Yeah.
And I don't mind it. Like, if I was like, I mean, it's not great, but it's a lot better than Sulu being on the damn show for 3 years and we never learn a thing about him.
Yeah, we learned one thing about him.
Yeah.
He looks damn good with a rapier in his hand.
He likes to fence. Yes, exactly.
well, Sulu may not have been the best example. There's a lot of subtle characterization before Chekhov shows up.
That's true. Like,
he has the gun collection that's mentioned in Sherry. He's got the botany background, and he has like lunches with Yeoman Rand. So those Sulu's got stuff. Like, it's not as a tabula rasa as like, say, a whore is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right? Like, she gets to do a lot of things in the early episodes, like singing and whatnot, but she doesn't really, we don't ever know what whole backstory is in the show.
Yeah.
Now, Discovery has done better. Season 2, Episode 2, New Eden. Owo, that's when we find out that Owo was from a Luddite colony. And she got to go on the mission with Captain Pike and Michael Burnham, because it is the Burnham show, and do things. And in that episode, she got to have like character bits.
Yeah.
That wasn't just staring at
exactly
at Detmer, right? Yep. It wasn't just that.
For what it's worth,
we kind of have like a, like, that's sort of the middle ground between the two. Like, here's this plot that goes nowhere, does nothing, and it's eating up a lot of all screen time. Mm-hmm. Versus, by the way,
yeah,
you know, in third grade, I got attention.
Right.
I know how to solve this problem.
I do feel like the show is less the Burnham show in this season. I mean, she's just on screen for a lot less time than she used to be on in previous seasons. And we get these B plots and C plots that she's not in. And I like that. Reno comes back. Do we have strong feelings on the return of Reno?
Huge fan of her, of the character and Tig Notaro. Like, I'm watching her like emote, and I'm just giggling in my seat because I'm like, this is her. This is her comedy. This is her. This is her in almost everything I've ever seen her in my entire life.
Yeah.
But damn it, do I eat it up every time? she toned it back a little bit because the egomaniac and Stamets had to spar. Painting Tarka with the broad brush. I apologize, but they had to establish, like, you don't appreciate or respect my professional acumen. But so they had to do that. So I understand why, from a production standpoint, you got to rein back some of that snark, but still just on fire. Just
great. Thoughts on Reno's return?
I think Jet Reno is great. I do think it's smart that they use holes sparingly. Mm-hmm. And I know the showrunners have said it's based on Tig's schedule, and I respect that. But it gives all that Guinan specialness. It gives all that Whoopi Goldberg special guest star. She hasn't had an episode like she hasn't had, like, outside of her introduction, she hasn't really had like the Jet Reno episode.
Yeah.
But she's gotten enough like moments, and she gets all the funny lines. I don't know if the ad libs, like, the line about, you know, this is as close as you've ever come to blowing us up, and that's saying something coming from, you know, from you. Like, that line is great.
Yes.
So she gets enough characterization that, you know, I like her. I appreciate having that sort of, you know, fly in the ointment. It's sort of like how she's portrayed. So, like, to Don's point, she couldn't be too much of a distraction from the main meta plot of setting up this potential villain.
I actually
was a little struck by how you characterize and summed up the episode, because for me the episode was Stamets and Saru and Tonka, and then there was this Michael Bonham plot to the side, and because Stamets is the only recalling character who interacts with the Cobalt plot, like he has that wonderful moment at the beginning and the end when he and kudos to Anthony Rapp for summing up the emotion, that look of reaching out to your partner and then having your partner brush you aside.
Yeah.
And the look of frustrated longing.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. I've seen that look and I've given that look. And that felt like a totally human moment. Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
And then having the "we can't get all shit together" joke at the end felt very sort of classic track, like they would always put the false joke at the end, especially like season 2 and season 3, and it never quite works. But I like how Discovery was like, no, we're just gonna do it privately, we're not gonna have a whole cast of people laughing at it, we're just gonna have these two people, and it's gonna be gallows humor.
I thought Cruz is so great in that scene. He's able to deliver those that dialogue so naturally, like it I felt like I was watching a loving couple having a conversation. It didn't feel like I was watching actors, you know, like Cruz is just such a wonderfully gifted and easy performer.
Yes.
And can we rewind a little bit though, to talk about his whole conversation with Cronenberg?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I figured we were saving that because it was the best part. I figured we were saving it for the end.
I think it is the best part. And I love the way it ends. I love it's like, I have a 2 o'clock. Goodbye. Yes.
Yeah. And to your point earlier about how this was written in the start of pandemic times, and you know that, you know, is that reflected in the show itself? And I almost called him Wilson Cruz. Colbert is at his limit. He's doing all these emergency sessions. Stamets, who before would be so wrapped up in their problems, is like noting, hey, you just had like 10 of these in a row. You can spare 10 minutes, and just to see him reaching out. So I'm infected by you calling him Cronenberg because I know his name. I've been calling his name, but because I watched this show as a companion piece of the series.
What is his name? Remind
Kovic.
Me. Kovich, that's right, yeah. Kovich.
So it's there, but like slowly, it's just being Mandela affected away.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm don't apologize. Sorry. It's great. No, he is a delight to see, like, because I know of Cronenberg by reputation, pop culture osmosis, whatever. But but more and more each week, you're getting there. But so to see him like this person who I've always thought of him as the character as. Section 31, if Section 31 wasn't so beat you over the head, like that subtle, sinister, I know everything about everything.
Yeah.
And then he's making a house call for dear Dr. Colbert, which I thought was great.
Yeah, he's always been in the previous season, he was much more sinister than he is in this season. I mean, he's Cronenberg is still Cronenberg, so Kovic is still kind of weird, but he was genuinely sympathetic and offered good advice to Tilly last episode, right? Like offers her the teaching position, which she accepts. And he's coming here and providing a house call. It's a Zoom call, right? Like if we want to talk about the effects of COVID, it's like, I've got 10 minutes. I cleared my calendar for you. Like, let's do this.
Yep. And I now have 8.5 minutes. So let's cut through the bullshit.
Yeah. Let's get to it.
And let me tell you about yourself, which was great too, because, when I watch things now, new things, current things that are coming out, trying very hard not just like COVID metaphor, but because I know that there are some productions that are trying their damnedest to not go down that path.
Yeah.
But this man is dealing, Cobra is dealing with countless people displaced. They once again try and sell the point like, hey, someone made this. And he's making a point like, I'm giving them hope. I'm lying to these people. Yeah. And like, if that doesn't scream the last coming up on 2 years, what doesn't? So like, and then he's reaching out to this person who gives him a form of absolute candor.
Yeah, yeah.
I sort of had the idea that Kovach already had the answer. Mm-hmm. Like it didn't matter. Like Wilson Cruz could have said, like Coble could have said anything. Mm-hmm. He could have said like, I'm really upset that I have to be a therapist to the current boyfriend of my captain, and the last boyfriend killed me. Like anything he could have said at that moment. Like really upset about my spaghetti. Like, and I sort of get the idea that Kovach would be like, okay, let's cut through the bullshit. Hill's actually the thing, and I'll back up. Like it didn't even matter. Like I just got that impression, and maybe it's because I've been in that situation where you can see someone struggling, and you know what they're struggling with, and you know them well enough that you can be like, okay, Hill's actually what it is. Let me slightly move your perspective, and now I gotta go.
Yeah. Is there what his line was? Was there any recommendation you can give besides the sparkling analysis?
Yeah,
and just the way they he delivered that line, I'm like he got you. You know, he got you. We all know he got you. But go ahead.
I liked the analysis, and I like Kovach telling us so plainly what Cobra's problem is, because I buy that problem. It's totally believable to me. Like, you know, okay, so I was dead and now I'm not. And like, so now what does that mean? What do I have to do? How do I validate the fact that I get a second chance, right? Like how many narratives are second chance narratives, right? And then 9 times out of 10, when you're telling a second chance story, the moral of that story is you don't get a second chance. Mm-hmm. And you have to learn how to embrace the first chance. And you have to accept your failures as part of who you are, because we don't get a second chance. But this is a science fiction show. And like so many superhero shows now, people come back from the dead all the goddamn time in these shows. Yeah. And so now that creates an interesting new question. Like, okay, you do get a second chance. Now what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. And I would love to explore that. I think a lot of our characters have come back from the dead. You know, I mean, Picard did it just last season. And, but we never really get a chance to explore what that does to a person. And it's different for Picard because he's already such an elderly man. Like the fact that he came back is really just more like a lease. Like, okay, you get to come back, but you only get a few years because, you know, your android body's going to die, and it's going to die at the same age you would have died normally. But it's not like that for Culber. Culber's a young man in the prime of his life, right? He in the Star Trek universe, he could easily live another 100 years.
Yeah,
and so it's different for him, and I really hope that we dwell on this and expand on it a little bit and get some thematic unpacking of it, because I think that it's a theme that applies across our favorite genres, to sci-fi and superheroes and fantasy too.
How many more episodes do we have this season?
We have 13 in total, and this is episode five.
Yeah, okay, because I know I went and looked. Okay, because Picard season 2, 211, so like it's going to butt right up against it. I don't think they'll dovetail that. They're much better writers than I am. They wouldn't be that bad about it, but like just how much more time do we get to have with Culber's growth with all these people dealing with this?
Yeah,
the closest we've ever gotten to an examination of this was Spock, right? Like, so Spock films, Social Spock, he comes back and his mom says, the training of your mind is in the Vulcan way. So the whole movie is him rediscovering all the humanity that he had come to peace with in the TV show, condensed in a comedy film, right?
Yeah.
So that's Spock's arc to get to the point where he can say, tell my mother I'm fine. Like, yep. And his I'm fine is the giant emotional outburst. And so it's like, ooh, wow, getting saucy here.
Yep. Please, not in front of the humans.
But, you know, we've killed off Ensign Kim several times on Voyager. We killed off Chief O'Brien and had him replaced by a double from him that was like 5 minutes older than the Chief O'Brien that died. Really, just all the awful things they did to Chief O'Brien, whether it was killing him or not, or like imprisoning him in the Cardassian planet or giving him the, like, we've never actually done an examination of what the trauma is, and doing that with the physician who's the, you know, physician heal thyself.
Yeah.
My notes. Really great. Yep. Who heals the healers?
Well, it reminds me a little bit of McCoy's big moment in Star Trek V, right? When he has to anesthetize his father, right? Yeah. And he goes through this huge trauma, and he's the doctor, and he has to heal himself. I don't know.
The difference is, and you know how much I love that scene. I fawn over that scene. That scene lives rent free in my head space. My counterpoint to that is, at least this is established in continuity. Like, this is a thing that we saw happen in a Jonathan Frakes directed episode. And then we saw him come back, and we saw him not deal with that. Like, he was a little emotionally distant. He got into a fist fight with the Poulsen who killed him, and that was what brought him back. Once he was on the Enterprise, and he was like, I can't leave Stamets, and he came back, right? Like, so super condensed, but we never actually have dealt with someone who died and then came back on the third day. What's the fourth day look like for that person?
Yeah, so I'm glad to see that, and I really want to dig into that. I think we have a unique opportunity here. I should say, it's not a unique opportunity. We've had this opportunity a lot, and we haven't done anything with it.
And that's, we have such a precedence of just dropping the ball now, and like, everything's good. He just needed some therapy and to shout it out. But now we have a chance to rectify,
I agree,
in Culber what we didn't get with all those others.
Well, so thoughts, other thoughts and comments? We've done a pretty good take on this show, I think.
I want to give one continuity shout out. Like, we got Tongo references. We got a lot of like little things. The alien race that is on the asteroid is actually from an Enterprise season one episode called Civilization. And the only reason why I remember that episode is because it's the Renaissance Fair episode. Like, it's we go to our pre-warp civilization, and we're going to put on Renaissance clothing and interact with these folks. And they just had the little bumps. So I was glad to see them back.
Well, that reminds me, actually, we never talked about Felix.
Oh, yep.
Oh, geez, like the emotional core of the episode. We just like, breeze past him.
Yeah. Don, you had some thoughts on Felix, I know, like that whole subplot. I want to know, by the way, I'll talk later. Don, you go ahead. What do you think?
I didn't have as much fleshed out on him, but like, that story was like, so powerful, and I don't know the actor, but he delivers it with such like somber emotion. That's much more, you know, everyone else just wants to get free, and like the way they unwrapped that particular onion was like, I'm not going unless we do this, and like, okay, then Michael spends some time. All due respect to Burnham, I feel like I would know that as a captain, I can grant asylum. Neither here nor there. I needed to get that out of me.
That actor, by the way, is Michael Greyeyes. He is a Plains Cree. Mm-hmm. Carry on.
Yeah. So I love seeing him in this. I love getting everyone else out, and he'll play ball, but he's like not going to let them out of the frying pan into the fire situation. So I thought that was really good. I thought that. I think the biggest thing for me that he did was he portrayed his obstinance in, this is what I'm going to do, this is my penance, so strongly that this is going to cause a schism. It did cause a schism, I feel, between Book and Burnham.
It did.
Because at the end of the day, like, there was this conversation about agency, which, as someone who is in the TTRPG space, like, player agency, like, that's a huge, I just had a conversation 2 days ago about it, and it's so important, and that they're talking about it, that they're addressing it. Like, this is like, there's this weird conversation. Probably I don't like to make too many false equivalencies if I can help it, but like choice, pro-choice, pro-life, like there's a whole thing that they didn't touch on, but like they are the right to die, I think the term, there's yeah. that. Yeah. So like, this is his choice. They're going to make it. There is the chance, like they had the chance, we could find an abandoned shuttle and escape, possibly. You know, we have the same chances of survival either way. We're either dead or we're in a brig. And to have like them to play along to the very last second, also here, take this Lagobi orb.
Right.
Which I looked, doesn't appear elsewhere. But was like everyone's like, oh, petty crimes, I shouldn't be here. Actually, I should be here. Yeah. Like, there's this whole thing of like, you know, he kept up appearances for 30 years. Those people didn't know anything other than what they knew from rumor or whatever.
Right.
Then to have him be there, not even defiant, just like, this is my penance. This is good and right, and this is my choice, which is the most important thing, which is touching but heartbreaking. And that shot of the planetoid lighting up as it entered the chronosphere just broke me.
Thea, what'd you think?
Well, I have ingested a lot of Star Trek episodes. I know how Star Trek thinks and feels. Sure. So when they introduced, when the camera lingers on a character and the way it was shot, I was like, okay, this guy's going to be dead by the end of the episode.
Yep.
And it's going to be his decision, because it's going to be the most heartbreaking thing that the show can give us in the time, whatever time they have allotted.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There was a Stephen Moffat was talking to Russell T. Davis about like an episode of Doctor Who, and he wrote it, and like the character died, like the main character in that episode just happened to die. I think it was Blink. And he's like, and Russell T. Davis sees this, and it's the only time he's edited him, and he sends it back and goes, "That's a Star Trek beat. That's Edith Keeler in front of the truck. This is Doctor Who. Doctor Who, wish fulfillment. You save Edith Keeler and stop the Nazis." Yeah. So I'm sort of like reminded of, okay, the ethos of Star Trek may be optimistic, but we're going to give you a ton of pathos before we get there.
Right.
But while we're there, we're going to give you a bunch of pathos. And I was just like, okay. And the actor was wonderful. I'm so glad that you wrote down his name. Gray Eyes?
Gray Eyes. Michael Gray Eyes, yeah.
Just fantastic looking like presence, yeah. And just such a stark counterpoint to the people, just even the people he was, you know, selling with.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, this is a, I don't even think they gave him the origins. He didn't have the, because he was supposed to be an outsider of some sort. Yeah. So I thought it was great. And I wish we would have spent more time on that. But that's always my refrain for Star Trek Discovery. It's, yeah. You know, give the show an extra 20 minutes or cut out an extra 10. Like, that's sort of always sort of my rubric on this show.
I was calling Felix Space Jean Valjean for most of the episode. Valjean's story, if you don't know Les Miserables, Valjean like escapes from prison. He hides in the house of a priest, and he proceeds to steal the priest's silver candlesticks. And when the cops show up and they're like, "Who is this guy?" And the priest is like, "Oh, he's my friend. He came by to pick up his stuff that he left at my house. Oh, and here, you forgot your silver plates. Let me give you all this other stuff too." Yeah. And he ends up reforming and converting, but and kind of seeing the light and changing his ways. But Felix is like, what if Valjean didn't do that and instead beat the priest over the head and stole the candlesticks?
Mm-hmm.
But still coming to the same point at the end, still coming to the point of I this is what I deserve. And I like, you know, Felix should have had like 24601 on his arm for all I care. But I liked it, and I thought that it was interestingly done. There's a name that my family has always used to refer to the thing that everybody wants, and they would call it the Whoopi. Which is the little orb thing, the Whoopi. I don't think we want to know how he hid that Whoopi from the guards all this time, I think that would be a the Quentin Tarantino version of this episode.
Oh God! Keep that name away from Trek.
Talk of metal.
But I loved it, and I thought that it was very strong. And honestly, I was mad at Book at the end because I'm like, Book, what do you want to do? Yeah. You want to stun this guy and carry him back to the ship unconscious? Like, is that what you're actually advocating for? And I honestly, the only explanation I really have for Book's actions is that he's still traumatized. That's why he's acting this way.
Yes.
And he's going to have to come around at some point and realize that he was wrong.
And part of that is, like, he sees Burnham bend over backwards in time and space to save every last person. And it works good for Burnham virtually every time that he sees it. So now that he kind of has that, I need to save everyone from this thing, and someone's doing this, I need to save everyone, that he's going, and he's like, he's out with Burnham, who on any other day of the week would probably say, like, oh, you know, everyone lives, very much that Doctor Who thing, just this once, everyone lives. And Burnham gets away with that. But with Book traumatized, definitely, when he wants to do the thing, Burnham suddenly got a cool head and saying, you know, citing agency, which, and Book very well could have just stunned him too. But, Michael Gray Eyes Felix says, yes, you could stun us all and take us with you. But Burnham knows she can't really do that. So to have the betrayal, not just be this, everything else going on, but Burnham could have chose this time to do that, but Burnham didn't this time. And yeah, he wants to be the savior.
Yeah.
So with the Book thing, this is where I get frustrated with Discovery and that list you brought up, the list of characters and what characters interact with each other.
Yep.
Is because when Rees makes, you know, when he has that moment on the bridge, I was like, oh, okay, we're gonna get some cross-pollination. We're going to see Rees and Michael working together because Admiral Vance already told us what the plot structure was. Saru, mm-hmm. you're on the ship. Michael, you're doing the evacuation. He's mm-hmm. he's already called that shot. So I was like, okay, he must have just read the script. Like, that seems seems pretty weird for an admiral to be saying that. But okay, maybe he knows, like, Michael's not going to stay on the ship. Like, maybe he's just accepted Michael for who she is. Like,
exactly.
Action Cork. So. Yep. Go do action cult stuff. but then you could have had Book, like, this is why it's all fancy writing, right? Like, then you could have had Book leading the evacuation and then Rees interacting. And then this plot point of agency versus, like, giving up the will to live may have worked a little bit better because we don't know anything about Rees. We've seen Book. We've seen a lot of Book from last season and this season. And it does feel out of character.
The good part about having Book on that mission, so they Burnham and Book have this break, but they have a rupture in their relationship by the end of the episode. And the reason why that works dramatically is because we actually see Burnham and Book rebonding.
Oh yeah, with the
duels. During the mission itself, mm-hmm. we had some of that, and I laughed to hear it. That thing that we did in the place that time, right? Mm-hmm. Where they start going off about all of their unseen adventures that we never got to actually see them do during that. Was it a 5-year gap?
Yeah, I think it was five.
Was it 5 years?
No, it's 1 year.
Remember, 1 year? Was it 1 year?
That was my problem was it's only 1 year separated. I need to be
you did
something.
Yeah.
You know, we could really see, like, Pirate Bone and being like, hey, I can't relate to anyone.
So that 1 year that she's with Book and they're working professionally for that year, and they have all of these crazy adventures that, you know, every Trek novelist is dying to sink their teeth into and just write, like, Burnham Book, The Lost Year, mm-hmm. you know? And we got a little bit of that. I was like, hey, you know, like, remember that thing that we did on that place that time? And he's like, yeah, I remember. And it was like season one again, you know, or last season again.
Yeah. So about that bit where they're bonding, they were saying, you know, I remember you shot up the noodle bar, and, you know, stuff happens next scene. Like, you know, I either shot the noodle bar or I shot the fusion reactor. And like, we sympathize with Burnham when she's, well, I sympathize with Burnham when she's like, yes. And I had noodles in my hair for days. and like that was a like a little hint at like I made a choice.
Yeah.
Noodle bar and reaction. I'm like, oh, that was a cute little moment. And they're like, oh, that's when we were playing it professional. That's when we weren't trying to find a more clever way of saying hooking up. But before that, and they were just like, you know, trying to keep it professional, like they were flirty. But then to go back around to another decision to make, like noodle bar, or like, you know, this person's agency, or saving one person in the face of your entire planet.
He doesn't want to be saved. Nope. He doesn't want to be saved.
Yeah, this is a cost of life, which is an episode from Next Generation, where Winchester from MASH, Dave Logan steals. He's romancing Lexana Troy, and he's like, no. This is how my people do it. I'm 40 years old. I die now. Mm-hmm. My daughter, like, this is how all planet propagates. And this is where the jaded Trek fan of me is like, no, you got 40 minutes of screen time, buddy. What are you going to do with it? How are you going to leave the emotional impression? So I'm kind of like, I don't like it. This has to sort of set up like a heel tone for Book. Like at some point, Book has to steal someone's agency, much like Bonham stole Stamets' agency at the end of season 3. Like this has to be that moment, because up to this point, Book is the empath. Like he's the empathetic one. He's like, I can't imagine the person be like, no, I need to force you to live for moral reasons. Like it seems like a weird setup. Like it needs some sort of payoff.
I think Tark, the whole staff of it. I'll bet you Tark is involved. Like that would be like you set up Book with Tark at the last moment of this episode.
Yep.
If and Tark was sort of we've established that Tark is really good at getting people to do what he wants. He's built a bond with Book by saying, you know, you're really angry. I get anger. Yeah. I anger is pretty useful to me.
Yep. And he points out that like, hey, you're also someone that can operate the spore drive, which has my brain on fire.
Yeah.
Because like, you know, I'm getting not quite Palpatine vibes of like, I'll watch your career with great interest. Why? the boy's 9 years old.
But, so we're gonna hijack the ship. I think we've figured out a plot twist.
Or they have it.
Well, they have a new spore drive ship. Mm-hmm.
They just need an operator. And
oh.
Tarka probably knows Stamets ain't gonna give up the Discovery, so you know, groom, for lack of a better word, Book to be sympathetic to his aims.
What is the new spore drive ship?
They haven't given us a name.
No.
We just know that there was a prototype ship with the spore drive. Because I think... No, I think Voyager has a new prototype of something else.
Okay.
Yes.
Is that Vulcan slipstream thing that they showed us in season 3?
Okay.
It could be the Voyager, and I'm just misremembering because, you know,
the Voyager has something. The way I read it was Tarka has something else entirely because Stamets helped them figure out the navigational problem, but they don't have an operator. Like, that was the key component they said in the first third of the episode was they just, besides Book and I, they can't fly, kind of.
Well, so that establishes that we've got another ship out there somewhere. And
I do think it's interesting that the Federation isn't putting all the eggs in one basket.
Yeah.
We brought the worlds together. We still have this old antiquated diesel thing. We need other solutions to faster than light travel.
Yeah.
We're going to try a whole bunch of different things. And, you know, it sort of breaks it out of the monotony of Star Trek just having warp drive for everyone and slightly different warp drive. Right?
This appeals to the gamer in me. Like, because if I'm going to do a setting and someone's like, well, what kind of faster than light travel do you have? And I'm like, all of them. Mm-hmm. I want all of them at the same time. It's just more fun. And it creates more interesting stories. But we can see a plot. I mean, we're not writing the show. I'm just seeing what I'm like. But where Tarka wants to do something, Tarka wants to do something. Stamets comes to his senses and says no, and doesn't back him up, and so he grabs Book and off they go in the other ship to go do something rash.
Yep. And also, is book ship destroyed or just no. just out of commission? Because I remember it took a beating when he was threading it. But like, I was like, oh, how many people can you fit in that big ass ship? Why don't you just configure it into one long parking bench for everyone to sit on?
I don't think it's.
I have feelings about book ship. Okay.
Yeah, it was basically just knocked around.
Okay.
It wasn't like a total loss. It was like adrift but salvageable line, right?
Yeah, okay.
From first contact.
He took some hit point damage, that's all. All right. So, do we have a title for next week's episode?
Oh, I didn't see. No. And also, I commend both of you for pointing out that we don't get next time on Star Trek anymore. I have to wait 3 or 4 days to see it online.
Well, they actually do. You have to seek it out. If you watch the Will Wheaton host show, they put it at the end right before the credits. I don't particularly watch it because I'm not that – I don't like the host shows just in general. They'll just kind of –
I tried with Walking Dead. I have all the respect in the world for Will Wheaton and his journey as a nerd and a Trekkie, whatever. But like, I can't. I'm doing this now. Like, I can wax poetic about the thing I love. That format doesn't appeal to me anymore. And so putting that after that makes perfect sense, and I understand.
Well, from what I've been able to determine, the title of next week's episode has not been announced. So. Okay. But regardless, we will be here, and Don, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Hopefully, we'd like to have you back sometime if you'd be open to that. Coming back on,
I very, very available. I would love to continue talking about this together.
Fantastic. Well, in the meantime, thanks everybody for coming, and we'll catch you next week on Space Force.
Peace and long life.